Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and welcome to an Hour of Mind Power. And this is something that, for me, is a very special day because we are going to be talking about how one person, in cooperation with a number of other people, can change the thinking in the world. It won't change everybody's thinking, but it creates a beginning of change that is ongoing and supported because of right thinking. What are we going to be talking about today? Well, we're going to be talking about the house that love built. Betty B. Youngs is my guest. This is going to be all about the story of Millard and Linda Fuller, founders of Habitat for Humanity and the Fuller Center for Housing. Betty, welcome to my show.
Thank you so much.
Now, Betty, you are a Pulitzer Prize-nominated author of 34 books, translated into 26 languages. You have been named Teacher of the Year. You're a university professor. You've appeared on shows throughout the nation. You are involved with wellness issues in the home and workplace. You are very much a person that's oriented to empowering people with information and solid research that goes behind it, which I think is just awesome. However, I'd like to know the story about how you got involved with the Fullers. This book is dedicated to them. This is about a phenomenal accomplishment, a dream that was carried forward by a husband and wife team that I don't think they even could begin to realize how far-reaching it would be around the world.
Well, I'm sure, you know, Habitat for Humanity actually came about because of a crisis in the Fullers' marriage. But the book is not dedicated to the Fullers as much as it is about their lives. But it is dedicated to all of us in the world so that we might kind of figure out how to stand shoulder to shoulder and truly help one another and remove the barriers that keep us into seeing one another as tall and short and thin and fat and green and white and, you know, political affiliations and so on. So it's really dedicated to just a wider sense of humanity and our ability to relate to one another just because we should.
How did you connect with the Fullers? What brought you into the environment that allowed you to entertain the idea that this is something that needed to be told in this wonderful book?
Right. Well, I have known the Fullers for many, many years. I met them because I had written a book and Linda had read the book and enjoyed the book, and I then served on just a number of house bills around the country for a long, long period of time. So I knew the work. I knew what the goal was and the mission was, and so I knew the story. And in a, you know, if we look, if we kind of go from the beginning, which is interesting, but all the way to right now, the Fullers have put, you know, a million people, they've housed a million people across the world in 100 nations. And so that is like no small feat to say. But it's, when I begin this book, it's really a 40-year history and kind of what led up to it all and through it and to their lives today. I actually start the book when Millard is six so that we can get an idea of what this personality must be like to have made changes in his life throughout his life, and then to grow an organization which became Habitat for Humanity, morphed into Habitat for Humanity, which is the largest nonprofit housing ministry in the world and is in 100 nations. I mean, it's very powerful to say. But Millard had a dream when he was small. He grew up in the South, and he simply wanted to, you know, be a business person and be rich. And by the time he was 29, he was an attorney. He was married to Linda, and he was wealthy beyond his means. He was the largest, at that point, the publisher of the largest publishing house for cookbooks in the world. And so, you know, he really did make his money. But he was so successful, he ran three shifts in his work. So a shift came in and left, another shift came in and left, another shift came in and left, and of course the price he paid for that was estrangement in his marriage, and he rarely knew his two children, and she left him. She said, this is, you know, we now have everything money can buy, but I don't have a husband, and we don't have a good family life, and this is not what I want. And he rethought everything and said, you know, the value of my family is everything, and you're right, wealth hasn't provided the answer to everything. It's provided comfort and security, but it hasn't provided happiness. And they literally gave every single penny of their money away, every single penny. And they simply said, you know, to God, here I am, what is it that you want us to do? You know, how would you have our lives? And they trusted, and they waited for that answer, and found themselves helping others build porches, put windows back in, repair roofs, you know, repair their houses. And they said, they really found that that was their calling, that their goal was from that moment on, and listen to this goal, the goal was to eradicate poverty, housing from the world, you know, from the earth. Is that an amazing story or what?
Yes, it is quite amazing. But let's back up a little bit, because there are so many significant portions in your book, The House That Love Built, about various people and pivotal situations that they went through. And I think about the profound experience they had in New York when they were in such a critical time in their marriage, and both of them were sitting on the steps, I believe it was St. Patrick's Cathedral.
That's right.
And they were sitting there, and that's when she told him about what had gone on in her life, because they were separated, and that's when they really realized it's quite a love story that she
had
put
in. It's a powerful love story, really, because it is fair to say that from the crisis in their marriage, Habitat for Humanity was born. It was birthed. If that crisis had not occurred, there's a great possibility that Habitat for Humanity would never have existed, because it was from that crisis where, you know, you're right, they were sitting on the steps, you know, just crying, looking back over their lives and saying, how did we start off with such a love, loving one another so much, of, you know, vowing to outlove one another, and then here we are with such a crisis, and we've become so estranged from one another. How did we get here? And then just made the commitment that, you know, for them, what they decided was to divest themselves of their wealth was a way to start over and to move aside all of what money had brought for them, which was more work, more time away from each other, and so on. So it is quite a love story.
Now, after that situation, after they gave their money away, they took what they called their first real vacation as a family. And they ended up going to Koinonia Farm, and it just is fascinating the way things fell into place, because Clarence Jordan was a man that had a tremendous impact on Fuller, just a tremendous impact on
him. He actually became their spiritual leader. You know, one of the things that this book is filled with, and it was something that I saw only after I had written the story, you and I might call them miracles, or other people might call them coincidences. But in fact, what really happens is you can see how in the whole scheme of our lives, everything really is given to us. You know, things that we need really is provided for us. You know, we have a saying that says, if the pupil is ready, you know, the teacher appears. And that happened for the Fullers time and time and time again. And in fact, it happened simply all the time. So when the Fullers are on this vacation on their way home, and you're right, it was the first family vacation they had ever taken. Imagine that. And they have two little children at the time. So they take this family vacation, and on their way back, Millard gets this idea that he wants to look up a good friend of his, and this friend is living at Koinonia Farms, which is a commune where blacks and whites live together, and everything is for the purpose of putting God's love in action. So, you know, there is community dining hall. People have their various roles to do. You know, children have a big playground where they can learn and play together, those sorts of things. And so they go to Koinonia to visit with their friend, and they had planned to stay an hour, and in fact they stayed a month. And during that first day, which was part of the reason why they stayed so long, Millard met Clarence Jordan, who founded it. He was a Greek scholar, PhD, and it was his goal in his life to really learn how to use his life only for what he felt was, he called it partnering with God. He said, every day I get up, I really want to say, what am I supposed to do today? And how is it that I'm supposed to do this for the good of others? And so every day that was his life. And here was Millard and Linda, you know, here they were. They had just, you know, given all of their money away and kind of said, okay, well, let's take a family vacation. But they were searching at that point. They were saying, well, God, what do you want us to do? I mean, what are we supposed to do now? And so when they moved closer to their month of staying at Koinonia, it's revealed. You know, they really understand that here are these people living with just kind of bare bones sorts of a lifestyle. They don't have tons of things, and they watch these people be so happy. They watch these people have such tremendous fellowship, raising their children, really valuing their children, really valuing family life, and really putting God's plan of action, you know, God's idea for just living without always chasing the dollar, you know, chasing really the relationship between us as people. So they find great solace there. They find great confirmation that, in fact, life can be lived without just chasing the dollar. And it's during that time that they help, again, create housing, create repairs on housing. And they love this idea. I mean, they love this whole idea that you can ask others, hey, there's four people down the street whose porches are falling off or windows are caving in or, you know, their roof leaks or their toilet leaks. Let's go help them. We don't have to get a grant from the government. Let's just, in our neighborhood, go help. And so they start this initiative called Partnership Housing. And, again, I explain all of this in the book. I mean, it's part of the story. And so after that month, you know, some other things take place in their life. And then they take this idea. They say, you know, let's just go test this idea. You know, can a community create housing for one another, even in the poorest countries in the world? And they go off and test it in some places around the world. They come back for a couple of years, 3 years, in fact. Then they bring it back, and they say, you know what, it works. And they say, if it works in those poverty-ridden places where resources are so scarce and people are so doubtful of one another, it can work anywhere. And they literally sit down and say, what is it then that is our plan? And they say, well, we've been helping humanity build homes, and a home is a habitat. Let's call this Habitat for Humanity, and Habitat for Humanity is birthed. And then in the next several chapters in this book, I talk about all of those years, because, you know, it's very easy to say, well, gosh, 1 million people have been housed and in 100 countries, but imagine for you and I, anyone who's just even moving, you know, from one house to another, imagine that. You know, the work. And so what I do is I trace the movement. I trace the first few years. I trace, you know, some of the phenomenal growth. Millard's goal was that Habitat for Humanity would become as well known as the Boy Scouts, because the money that comes in is what is used to build the homes. And then, of course, you have all the volunteer work. And in year 8, when Jimmy Carter comes out of the office from his presidential term, you know, they are neighbors, and they go to the same church. And Carter says, you have a really good thing going on here, and, you know, do you need some help? I need a legacy after the White House. And he becomes, over the years, their most famous volunteer. And so then, I just trace, you know, the next 40 years and or the next 30 years of Habitat. And then, of course, Millard and Linda were fired in 2005 from the very organization they birthed and had become such an integral part of their lives.
Yes, and that was very significant to me because of how it was done, and we'll get into that in a minute. But one of the points I wanted to bring out, and you covered it a little bit, is that prior to getting Habitat for Humanity, Millard Fuller is a man who is so skilled as an entrepreneur. He has such superb business skills that he is asked by Tougaloo's Board of Trustees to help with their fundraising skills, and that's what began the journey of those 3 years where they traveled around the world. And they, as you said, had this phenomenal exposure to different things, different living conditions. And there is a portion that you talk about, one particular area, I believe it was in Africa, where they found that the system of bribery was so strong they were arrested, what, how many times? I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Well, part of it was not, bribery a little bit, but part of it was that, and this was in the, late 60s and early 70s, part of it was that when the missionaries had gone there, and so the Fullers were a part of that, when some of the tribesmen would find these foreigners, per se, they would instantly think, okay, they've got money. So sometimes they were just, they would be riding a bicycle and would be pulled over again and again, sometimes up to 20 times a day they would be arrested, and the goal for those who arrested them was simply to, bribe them for money. Okay, we'll let you go, for $5. Or okay, well, we'll not keep you or put you in a cell if you've got, if you pay us $3. And part of it was just bribery. So at first the Fullers paid it, and then eventually they realized that this was just part of, getting money and just, a way to do that. So the Fullers just refused to pay, and then of course that went away.
Right, but they had to learn, and that's what I found so fascinating. You've done such a superb job of presenting information about what they went through and how they adapted, the things that they wouldn't tolerate. They gained so much strength from doing this international work. And when Millard in 1985 projected that Habitat for Humanity would work in more than 1,000 U.S. cities and 50 countries by 1995, it was almost accomplished. By 1995, Habitat for Humanity worked in 1,136 cities and 47 countries.
Amazing, isn't it?
It is incredible. But
and here's why it became successful. First of all, the Fullers had a goal that they wanted to eradicate poverty from the face of the earth, and they were very clear on that goal. They felt that, that this was their calling, to build homes for others. And part of what they needed to do then was to marshal the leadership to bring to the minds of people that don't wait for someone else to fix the house down the street. You fix it. You get together your community and go fix it. And by the way, those poor people who truly are, destitute, get them a house, build them a house, and don't wait, don't apply for some grant to do it. Just, within your community, you really do have the wherewithal to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fullers felt they could do this around the world. And what they really wanted to do was to put a Habitat for Humanity model in every city in the country and in every country on earth so that people could see what it meant that, that yes, we as brothers and sisters of the human race can eradicate poverty housing. We don't have to wait for someone else to do it. We have the will, if only we can find a way if only we have the desire, if only we find the will. And so that was their goal. And so they were relentless and tireless crusaders for bringing in funds from everyday people and then saying to those people, come y'all, let's go build these homes. And they did to the tune of, they housed 1 million people by 2005.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring out some of the points in your book because there frequently are concerns when people have nonprofit organizations that the money's not going where it's supposed to go. Well, when he was in charge of Habitat for Humanity, it was, as you put it in your book, a bare-bones operation, and he hardly took any money out, and his management skills, his money skills, were so valued and respected. He kept a tab on everything, and every cent that they received from donations found its way to building a home for a family in need. They really did. They walked the walk. They just didn't talk the talk. And it's phenomenal how you bring things out. And when President Carter became involved with it, this was prior to the humongous situation that occurred when Millard Fuller was fired from Habitat for Humanity, and you bring out that information so clearly and concisely. He had such a sense of pride in this, and not only was it President Carter and his wife, but there were people like Paul Newman, other people very prominent positioning that just loved knowing that whatever they put in here, one, they could participate in the activity themselves, but their dollars were really going to be used, and everything was tracked. And this you don't often find. You will find many times things go the other way, but that wasn't the case.
And well, again, part of it is, first of all, that's their nature, and that was their commitment, you know, to their own God, that they would help others. And they just felt that if you and me and everyone else gave their $25 or $50 or $100 or $500,000 or whatever our contribution was, even if it was our sweat equity, we're going to go help build. He didn't feel that the public meant that that money should be spent on big salaries. He did not feel that those in the sector of caring for others should get rich when they said to others, "Help us build homes for others. Help us help others." He felt that's what they should do. That the monies that came in should go out the door. Millard said that he prided himself in being a successful leader, if every morning the monies that came in, at the end of the day, the monies were out. They were out the door already helping someone. He prided himself in his organization always, quote, staying broke, which is, you know, a little bit of why when some of this Hurricane Katrina money came in to the new to Habitat now, and they banked a lot of it, you know, Millard was furious. He was disappointed, I guess is the better word. But again, his goal was to create an organization that was as well known as Boy Scouts, so that people could just really look at the organization and see his leadership as transparent. Millard was fired in 2005 from Habitat for Humanity by the board, certainly not by the volunteers or the affiliates, but he was fired because there became this tremendous philosophical difference. Some of the newer people on the board felt that they wanted to change the culture of Habitat. There was a plaque, you know, in front of the Habitat for Humanity offices that said every house is a sermon of God's love, and they took it down immediately. They wanted to move the offices from a small town where overhead was low into a larger city and into a huge high rise where it was going to take a whole lot of volunteer money to pay those fees. And they raised salaries four times what Millard was making. And all of this was made Millard just distraught, and he fought it. He said the culture of the organization is about a housing ministry. It doesn't need to be a mega conglomerate. And yes, you know, Habitat for Humanity is worth $1.8 million, but it doesn't have to be managed like a corporate, like a mega conglomerate. It doesn't have to be managed in an organizational style per se. You know, it can be managed as a grassroots level organization, because he wanted people within communities to build houses and to help one another within those communities, and communities vary greatly, and most especially from around the world. So there was a tremendous falling out eventually in 2004 and 5, and in 2005 the board fired him. Boards can fire, you know, a CEO and founder, and they did. And so, you know, that philosophical difference really was Millard saying, I'm not going to buckle. I'm not going to let this organization turn from a movement, you know, from a grassroots level organization where people help one another into simply a conglomerate being managed from the top down. This is, you know, like, you know, very much franchise style. And he said, this is not going to be. And so when he was fired, he simply then started the Fuller Center for Housing and said, you know, here I am, Lord, send me, you know, if this is your will that I just continue helping house others and eradicate poverty housing, let me know. And sure enough, he felt that's what he was to do. And the Fuller Center for Housing now, it's not 2 years old yet, and it is as large as Habitat for Humanity was in year 8. I mean, the abundance is enormous. And the way the rest of us can look at that is simply that people have had 30 years of Millard's leadership, where he has been such a good custodian, such a good steward, such a diligent steward of people's money, that they trust him and they're following him. You know, they see him as a shepherd. They understand that his mission is very pure. At any rate, this entire journey then, I track from when he was 6 all the way through now, where the Fuller Center is 2 years old. And, you know, I mean, he's had lots of public recognition. I mean, he is a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest civilian honor in the world. He's got 50-60 honorary doctorates. He's got every award in the world. So
right.
He's quite an icon. He's been called one of the most important figures of the 20th century.
Now, one of the traits of Millard Fuller and his wife, which I really appreciated that you shared in your book, is that, and you're very clear about the information regarding him being fired and him being taken out of that environment. I know President Carter, you quote, "My impression then was that there were ambitious people who wanted to gain control of the organization, even at the expense of the Fullers, Carters, and many others." But Millard Fuller and Linda decided, you state how Linda said she gave herself, I think, 3 days. And then she said that's enough of that.
She said she threw a pity party for 3 days.
Yeah, pity party for 3 days. And Millard said, "No, I'm not gonna try to go to court. I'm not gonna try to do anything like this," because he probably would have won in the court of law. But he would have spent all of that money. He had been an attorney. He knew what that involved. And he said, "Why?" And instead, starting his new organization, and he didn't slam dunk mud towards the Habitat for Humanity. He figured that what he was going to do, he was just going to go about doing it. He is 70 years old, I believe, and he's healthy and he's strong. You'd never know he was in his 70s. And he has a passion for what he's doing. He started it up, and within a month, he had his board of directors. Within a month, he had funding coming in from right and left. He had money coming in from all over the world, because as people became more informed about what was going on, they got very upset. But the support was there, and he said the important thing is to do the work. And like you said, in 2 years, what had taken him so many, many years before to accomplish, he was now accomplishing in 2 years, and it's just growing. What is his dream? What is he looking at?
He has the single focus of the dream he started off with. His goal is to eradicate poverty housing around the world. And the way the first goal to do that for him is to put a model for people within each nation, within each community, within those nations, how to do that. So he firmly believes that if he can come to your community and to my community and to everyone's community and show them how to help everyone within that community get out of poverty housing, you know, slums, if we can help one another, and we will, if we will rise to the occasion of taking it upon community within community within community within community to cure, per se, poverty housing, to lift those who are in poverty housing out of that, if we can do that, he believes then that we teach people within communities the model for so doing, and that it will continue and continue and continue. Because, you know, if you've helped 3 or 4 people within your community build a house and they have a decent place to live, and you've given them the support of getting their kids back into school, and you've said to them, "Come on, join us as a community, get in here and let's help some others do the same," and you do that time and time again, well, then what you do is you teach the community how to help themselves help one another. And that's his goal. And that's his plan for eradicating poverty housing as well.
Now, Betty, you have a website. What is that website that people can go to?
It's www.bettyyoungs.com, and Betty is BETTIE and then YOUNGS.com. And you can also catch into the FullerCenter.org as well.
FullerCenter.org. Betty Young is the author that has put this phenomenal book together. It's a story that will have you gripped from the moment you start reading the first page. And you'll realize it's a story that has a phenomenal history to it, but it's a living, breathing reality today. The story is far from being finished.
That's
about
for
the
sure.
This
guests can also, your readers and listeners can also take a look at www.amazon.com and see some of the phenomenal reviews by those around the world.
Great. The House That Love Built, the story of Millard and Linda Fuller, founders of Habitat for Humanity, also the Fuller Center for Housing. Betty, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much.
It has been a wonderful show. We're going to be coming back with more good things to share. Don't forget, BettyYoungs.com. Go to her website. Also, you can go to the Fuller Foundation website as well. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
That 800 number again, newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
This is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are open. If you're a first-time listener to the Donna Sebo Show, I invite you, as well as any of those that have listened to the show regularly, to call in if you'd like a little bit of intuitive insight into your life to 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, we have a direct line of 530-876-3222. Now, remember, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. After that, you're welcome to listen to what I have to say, and then you can ask me a question about anything that you are interested in. Again, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, or 530-876-3222. Well, for those of you who are regular listeners to the show, you know how I enjoy giving out recipes. I do love to cook, and the holidays afford me an opportunity to get out some of my family favorite recipes, like my stained glass fruitcake and some other things that over the years have become just what's expected to be had at the home of the Sebos. Well, there are so many wonderful recipes out there, and if you have something you'd like to share with me so that my listeners can add something special and unique to their menu, then why not send me an email? You can send it to donna@delphiinternational.com. That's D-E-L-P-H-I, and then the word international.com, and yes, there are two I's back to back. And just send me along the story about the food and what's so special about it. It's just a delight to hear those stories about those very special items that you fix during the holiday season, and let's share it with people. I found that a friend of mine, we were talking about recipes last night, and it's so much fun to share things with people because they may have an idea, a concept for something that you would never have thought of. And we're all so very busy with all the activities. My goodness, if you're involved with parties, I was talking to my husband this weekend. I said, gracious, do you realize that every single weekend we have something going on? It's just incredible. Well, it's that time of the year. People love to share. People love to cook, and they're out there. Now, I came across a recipe using phyllo dough, and I wanted to share it with you, because this one talks about having tartlets made out of phyllo dough. And the first time I ever became acquainted with that concept was actually this past summer. And my girlfriend, whose schedule was so busy, and she makes these absolutely magnificent tarts, lemon curd tarts that are just, they're just perfect. They're small. You pop them in the mouth if you have a batch of people over. It's just wonderful. Well, she didn't have a lot of time to spend on the dough, on making the dough that goes into the tartlet pans, and you press it in, and you do all kinds of stuff, and you bake it, and this, that, or the other. So she decided she was going to use phyllo dough, and they were wonderful, and it was so quick and easy. All she did was cut up the phyllo dough, put it in the pans, and off it went. Well, these are some caramelized onion tartlets, and if you're going to be having some parties, and you want something that's easy to fix, I'm going to be sharing this with you today. And also, I want to say these are fun. You can use the same concept for a pie filling, for anything that you want, like my girlfriend did. And they're light, they're crispy, not crispy to the point where they'll fall apart when somebody picks them up, but if it's got such a strong constitution, the phyllo dough does to it, that it just creates a wonderful, wonderful look, and also it's so handy and relatively inexpensive and time-saving to use. So if you've got that pad of paper and pen handy, go ahead. If you don't have it, get it ready yet. Let me give you a tip about making holiday cookies. If you're like me, usually when you're going to do some baking, you have time increments that you can work with. And preparing dough always takes time. But if you can, just use these few tips, and I've used them over the years. Cookie Pro, his name is Mark Heyman. He's the assistant professor at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. He said so frequently, if we are good at what we do when we're celebrating the holidays, we have more and more people that we have in our homes and in our offices, so we seem to have to make more and more. And lots of times we just don't want to go out and bake something. It seems like with the holidays, or buy something that's already baked, we really want to have something that comes from home. It seems like there's an extra special something. I call it that cook's love that goes into the food preparation. It really makes a difference. So his suggestions are suggestions that I developed years ago, but I want to share them with you because they really make a difference. If you make your dough ahead of time and roll your dough into a cylinder, a cylindrical log, and just look at the ones that are in the grocery stores, you know, that you buy, they're already there, and you just do the same thing for yourself. And what you do, you wrap it in parchment paper, and I like to then also, I'll use either parchment paper to wrap my cookie dough, or I will wrap it in wax paper, whatever I have handy. And then, to keep anything from getting a freezer burn, this is me, I'm super cautious. I wrap it in saran wrap and then maybe put it in foil. If I have more than one roll, then I'll just put it in a combined foil package and label it on the outside so I know what it is. Because you can make this up to 3 weeks in advance. And if you want to really save it for longer, it'll keep in plastic wrap just by itself for 2 months. And you can do this with all kinds of doughs like chocolate chip, biscotti, gingerbread, oatmeal. And all you have to do when you know you're going to have the time to bake is take those logs, those cookie logs, out of your freezer, put them in the fridge, and just let them thaw out in the refrigerator. If you let them thaw out on the kitchen counter, if your kitchen's really, really warm and you've used butter, you're going to find that they are affected by that. So thaw them out in the refrigerator. It works better for you. Then slice them and bake them. Now, whatever you do, he says, do not store the cookies in the freezer or the fridge. They won't taste as good. Make sure you put them in cookie tins. Great stuff. It's a real good idea. And I put wax paper between my cookie layers. Let's take our first caller for the day. Hi, welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
This is Lyle from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Hi, Lyle. Welcome to the show. Getting ready for the holidays?
Yeah, well, I'm getting that way. I will when I have a few days off close to Christmas.
Oh, I know what that's like. Oh, boy, but I just love the holidays. Hope you get the time. You make the time. Make the time, Lyle, to go out and just look at things. That's what my husband and I are going to be doing because it's so much fun when you just go out and about into the areas that are just all decorated up and the music is going. It's just, it's great. You don't have to spend a whole bunch of money. Just go. With the people you love, it's really great. Well, let's get down to business with you, Lyle. First of all, there is something that is agitating you, and you are letting the agitation get to you. And you must ask yourself why. And I think if you have integrity with yourself, it will be because you don't feel like you have control. And I want you to learn two words, trust and then the word release. Trust and release. That's been something that's really been a challenge for me in my life, because I like to think that I can have everything organized and in perfect order. But when you've done everything you can do, then you need to trust and release. Let it go and move on to something else. Don't put everything, all your expectations, all your hopes and desires into just one particular perspective. Realize that there's a heck of a lot of options out there, and you want to be able to work with as many as possible. You want to work with multiple. You want to keep your focus on what your objective is, but you want to be open to different venues that can afford you opportunity. Also, what I want to say is travel. You want to make sure that your vehicle is in good condition, because you're going to be on the road quite a bit. There's a lot of conversation. Apparently, there's going to be a level of salesmanship that's going to be involved in this conversation with other people. And I want you to feel comfortable with the vehicle that you're going to be commuting in, so that you're not going to have unnecessary stress relative to that. But you have got a major step forward that's occurring between the 8th and 28th of February. So you just need to have that expectation and that sense of preparation. And then it seems like the work is coming in full bore, and you are going to be going a mile a minute. So keep your priorities straight. Keep your focus where it needs to be. If you feel that you're hitting stone walls, just look at them and say, okay, that may be a stone wall. What are my other options? Look at life as you would a video game. Just because you get bleeped out occasionally doesn't mean the game's over. You can start it all over again. So remember, you've got a lot of different directions that you can follow. Have integrity with yourself. Stay true to who you are. You're not going to miss the boat. What question do you have for me today, Lyle?
Well, I have a court. Well, it's not set yet, but I have a court date that's coming up sometime soon, and I was wondering how that case will go.
Well, I don't know what the situation is. I am looking at the word delay. So I think what you need to do is take advantage of whatever time you have available to you for preparation. And what you need to look at are the issues that are going to be dealt with by the court itself. You need to have someone, and if it's your attorney, that's a good thing, but you need to look at what is going to be presented, what the real issue is at the court, and how you must present yourself, and it must be with clarity.
Okay.
Don't go off on tangents here.
Okay.
Look at what really needs to be looked at and see it and try to examine it from every perspective so that you will have the information and resources available to you that will enable you to present your positioning in the best and most appropriate way with clarity so there will be no confusion.
All right. Thank you very much, and enjoy the other holidays.
I absolutely am enjoying the process, and you do the same, my friend.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Lyle. This is Donna Siebel. Hey, we're going to go on break, and when we come back, I've got that caramelized onion tartlet, that recipe that I'm going to share with you. And don't forget, send me the story about your favorite recipe and why it is your favorite. I want to hear all about it. Send it to me via email with your story, and I'll be able to share it on the air. Donna Siebel here. It's DelphiInternational.com, Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's the email. Look forward to receiving it. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a minute.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Siebel. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Siebel's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Okay, here is the recipe for caramelized onion tartlets. Great as an appetizer, and it's just good for anything. If you had people coming over and you needed to fix up something quickly, this is terrific. Oh, does it look so pretty. Now, what you're going to need is 2 tablespoons plus 1/2 cup of butter. 2 tablespoons plus 1/2 cup of butter, and that's going to end up being divided up. You're going to need 2 large sweet onions, and I mean large sweet onions, 2 large sweet onions or 4 small ones chopped. You're going to need 1/4 cup of sugar, 3/4 cup of hot water, 3/4 cup of hot water, 1 tablespoon of beef bouillon granules, 1 tablespoon of beef bouillon granules. You're going to need 1 cup, about 1/4 pound of shredded Swiss cheese. And you're going to need 8 sheets of phyllo dough. 8 sheets of phyllo dough. And they're 14 by 9 inches in size. You can get them at any grocery store. Now, this is how simple it is. In a skillet, you're going to melt 2 tablespoons of your butter over medium heat. You add your onions and your sugar together. And you're going to cook them for 15 minutes. And just don't let them sit there. You want to stir them frequently. And they're going to get this wonderful golden tone to it. Just maybe ever so slight brown tone. And then at that point, 15 minutes are really well cooked. You're going to stir in your water and your bouillon, and you bring it to a boil. And then you're going to reduce the heat, and you just let it simmer uncovered for 5 to 7 minutes or until all of the liquid has evaporated, and keep stirring. Then you want to remove it from the heat, and then you stir in your 1 cup of shredded cheese. Now, what you do then, you melt your remaining butter, and you can just do that if you want to nip it in your microwave, like for 30 seconds or less. You brush 1 sheet of your phyllo dough with butter. You distribute the butter evenly, and you keep the remaining sheets covered with plastic wrap and a damp towel because it dries out real fast. You top with another sheet and brush with butter, and you cut it into 12 squares. Now, you take 1 square and put 1 into each of 6 greased mini muffin cups. Press 1 square into each of 6 greased mini muffin cups, and you top each with another square, placing the corners off center. And then you spoon 1 tablespoon of your onion mixture into each cup, and you repeat the process 3 times. And you bake them at 375 degrees for 10 to 15 minutes. You serve them while they're warm. They're good cold, too, but warm is really nice. Makes 24 delectable items. What a neat, light appetizer to serve a group in your house, a company. And you don't want them to eat too much in appetizers. Have you ever had a fabulous dinner and then found that you had so many appetizers and people scarfed up on the appetizers, and when it came to sit down to dinner, they went, "Oh, Lord, I can't eat anything because I'm so full." No, I learned that lesson a long time ago. You want a little bit of something available to your guests, and then when time comes to serve dinner, you have it. If you're having a party where it's all appetizers, who cares? But this is a wonderful, wonderful recipe. Caramelized onion tartlets. Easy to make, quick to fix, deliciously flavorful. If you want a little bit of color on the top, sprinkle a little bit of paprika. Just a few sprinkles that give that little bit of red on the top. Won't affect the taste very much, and it will look just absolutely beautiful. So I wanted to share that with you. And I'll have some cooking tips between now and the holidays that perhaps will help you along. But, oh, it's such a joy to prepare for the holidays. I know at our house, we have this huge group of people. We've been doing it, my goodness, for so many years. And it's just such a joy to be able to share good food with people that you enjoy spending time with, and your house is decorated. And it's just a wonderful time for fellowship. We just thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy it. Okay, I had said I was going to finish up our winter horoscope. We had gone through the signs of Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Cancer, Leo, and Virgo. Who do we have left? Well, we've got Capricorns, Aquarians, and Pisceans. Yes, so that's what we're going to do. Let's go for those of you born under the sign of Capricorn. This is your winter horoscope for December, January, and February. Well, if you're a Capricorn, you're one of those people, you are going to want to have a party in your home because that's what you love to do. You really love to socialize with people. It is going to be absolutely awesome for you. You're going to be known as the host or hostess of the year, and you are just going to find that it's just a great time. People are really going to appreciate you, and you are going to have a fabulous, fabulous holiday season. Now, in January, if you're a single person, apparently romance is going to be on your mind big time. But what's really going to make a difference is you're really feeling good about yourself under the sign of Capricorn. You're really focused on achieving your dreams, and by golly, you know what? You're going to have all the tools you need. It's whatever is necessary for you to reinvent yourself and to get your life to where you want it to be. You are going to make sure that the goals that you really, really desire are going to be center stage. And, you know, in February, you are going to be really taking a look at your budget, and you're going to eliminate unnecessary expenses, and you're going to really have a stronger connection with who you are, what you want to accomplish, and where you want to be in your life. So that's for the Capricorns. Aquarius, December, friendship is going to be very much of the focus. Now, by golly, you need some time off for yourself. You guys always so busy. You need to be taking better care of yourself. If you're born under the sign of Aquarius, please do not run yourself down. Be good to yourself. Give yourself some personal time, especially during the holiday season. And boy, are you going to be lucky. January seems to kick off a very positive year for those of you born under the sign of Aquarius. You are really going to feel like luck is on your side. And in February, your intuition's going to be working overtime, and you are really going to be able to see things clearly, mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. For those of you under the sign of Pisces, well, in December, looks like you've got an opportunity to work into a promotional positioning. You are going to feel very independent and also very aggressive about what you're going to set up for new objectives for the new year. And in January, I think personal life is going to take the foremost important positioning in your life. You may want to redecorate your home. You're also going to be evaluating who do you want to be involved with, who do you not want to be involved with. And in February, you are really going to lighten up. You're going to say, enough is enough. I've worked hard. I need a break. I'm going to see what I can do for fun. And you are really going to give yourself some personal time that you're really going to enjoy. So that's the last three signs of the zodiac, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. We are out of time, and I want to let you know tomorrow we're going to be talking with Judy Strong, No Time to Grieve. Wonderful lady. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Earlier in this hour, we were talking about how one man and his wife had a dream to provide homes for people that maybe would not otherwise afford them. Any one of us can have a dream. You can affect this world in a special way, but you're the one that has to step up to the plate. If it requires additional education, go get the education. If it requires daring to be different, do it. Don't be afraid to give the best of what you have in life, because I'll tell you what, the universe will reward you in ways that you would never have dreamed. Be true to yourself. It's a good day to be alive. And you've got a wonderful journey ahead of you. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.